The Book Club at 91.7. I'm Mark Purcell. He's the science correspondent with The Economist and has written a book called The Science of Monsters. Now Matt Kaplan has a new book out called The Science of the Magical, from the Holy Grail to love potions to superpowers. It explores many, many different aspects of what you call might call magic, but that involve a lot of science. Matt Kaplan, welcome to the Book Club at 91.7.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you started out with monsters. How did the science of monsters lead you to the science of the magical, Matt?
The boundary was witches. So I was working up science of the monsters, writing about what kinds of things led our ancestors to invent the mythology of the vampire. And where did werewolves come from? And what about the Minotaur? Where did this stuff come from? And did our ancestors just imagine it? Or were there things in the natural world that they couldn't understand and needed to explain in some way? And as I was working through that book, I ran into sorcery and witchcraft. And, you know, where do you place a witch? Is a witch a monster, or is a witch something else? And then as I started to explore that topic more fully, I realized, oh boy, I've just hit a hornet's nest. There is so much that our ancestors got involved with, whether it was holy grails, or following animals, believing that they were omens and guides of the gods, or even going back to the issue of witches, where does the magic wand come from, and why did our ancestors believe that it had some sort of power? So as I delved into all of that, I realized, okay, there's no way this can fit into the science of monsters. It's got to be a separate book.
And it seems like you went off on something you love because, you have Marvel characters in here, the Princess Bride, you got Homer's The Odyssey, you have, I have to read Daniel Blumstein's quote that's on the book cover. What do the Princess Bride, The Odyssey, Super Mario Brothers, and the Book of Exodus have in common? Answer Matt Kaplan's ingenious curiosity, because really you are tying all these things together, and until you pointed out the connections, I hadn't made those connections, Matt.
You know, I didn't set out to make the connections either. So, you know, Super Mario Brothers seems so completely insane to attach to all of this other material. But that story alone is kind of mind-boggling. I was working up this piece about doping in the Olympics before London hosted the 2012 Olympics, which I was in London for. And I wrote this piece up about how athletes were cheating and how hard it was for scientists to keep up. And the artist at The Economist who was doing the cartoons for my article, you know, we did this little introduction with the history of doping. And among the things, we know that the Inca chewed on coca to stain pain so that they could do heavier labor. We suspected that people in ancient times were smoking things to improve their performance. And there was this one drawing of a Viking with a red and white speckled mushroom in its hand, and he was raging at the mushroom. And I thought nothing of it at the time, but I spent a lot of time looking at the Norse mythology over the past year, and you've got a lot of Viking literature where it says that the warriors, as they traveled up to fight their enemies, would rage. They could be downed by neither fire nor iron, and they often believed they were beasts. And so the theory for hundreds of years is they were high on something, and the large argument has been it had to have been this red and white mushroom called Amanita muscaria. So that's where the artist for my article got it. But once I started looking into the biochemistry of the mushroom and all of the literature, I realized the literature had to be wrong, because Amanita muscaria makes you nauseous, it makes you dizzy, it sedates you. This is not the kind of thing you would take before raging and then killing Frenchmen. It's just, you would never do that. And I started interviewing all these toxicologists and saying, well, am I right? Because I'm a science journalist with a paleontology background. How am I going to know about the poisoning of a mushroom? And they all agreed with me, including a bunch of guys at the toxicology unit at Children's Hospital in Boston who are experts on what happens when you put stupid stuff down your mouth. And then I started looking at the archaeological literature. In recent years, researchers have started to notice henbane seeds in the graves of Viking sorcerers. And henbane's interesting. The Greeks used it to deal with toothaches, but if you massage henbane into your skin and use it properly, it makes you feel like you're flying, it numbs you to pain, it makes you feel amazing, and you hallucinate. So I think that rather than a red and white mushroom, Super Mario Brothers style, I think it was probably henbane that they were using. But it led to a remarkable exploration that I never even expected to get into.
And then that ties into the first Avenger, Captain America.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. We like to look back at our ancestors and go, oh, yeah, they explored the natural world and their activities inspired their stories to some extent. And we're so different because we're so modern and wonderful. But you look at where we were at when Captain America came into being, and people were just starting to explore drugs that could alter the body, drugs that could enhance performance in all sorts of ways. Of course, the Vikings were doing it, but Captain America is a natural progression. Could you dope somebody to the point where they could function as a superhero? And while that was kind of exciting and speculative back when Captain America was created in the middle of the 1900s, today it is scary real, as I discovered while writing stuff up for The Economist. You can shuttle viruses into the body that will transform your DNA permanently so that you begin producing compounds that help you to perform better as an athlete. Totally illegal, totally unethical, very, very real. So, you know, our modern mythology, Captain America, there's a new one coming out in a couple of months, Captain America Civil War, and this reflects a lot of what's going on in our world. Mythology is not to be ignored. It has a major part in recording what we know and what we're thinking about.
Matt Kaplan, he is the author of Science of the Magical, From the Holy Grail to Love Potions to Superpowers. His previous book was The Science of Monsters. But The Science of the Magical, Matt, boy, as I was saying before we went on the air, there's so many things to talk about. I'm not really sure which to focus on, but I'm curious where you began, because you talk about the Holy Grail, you talk about fortune telling and love potions, and I mean, the list goes on and on. Was there a starting point you had
getting this
together?
I was in Italy, and I was going to an oracle, because I'm a history buff. I love going to ancient sites, and I was traveling with my friend Charlie out to this oracle near Avernus near Naples. And as I went to the oracle, it's labeled in all of the modern pamphlets and history books, you know, Fromer's Guide and what have you, that it is an oracle to Apollo. Apollo is a sun god. He is a god of light and youth and health. And I'm walking into the oracle's inner chambers, and it's dark and terrible and scary. And I just took a quick compass bearing as I was down there and realized, wait a minute. The only openings in this temple are to the west. You wouldn't even get the rising sun's light in this room. All you'd get is the end of the setting sun shining through in a sort of macabre red. Why did people put Apollo here? Why would they put a prophet of Apollo in this room? How could you do prophecies in such a place? Well, you look actually at the archaeology of the site, and the modern take on it is actually wrong. While it did ultimately become rebranded as a Temple of Apollo, where an oracle would sit and give you prophecies in the name of that god, it started as an oracle of Hera. Are you familiar with Hera at all?
Oh, yes.
Hera was the jealous wife of Zeus. That's how most people know her.
Right.
And she was very tightly associated with childbirth, which shepherds life into this world. But her very earliest portfolio also included shepherding life out of it. She was a goddess of shades and the gateway to the underworld. And the site, while that dreary oracle was originally dedicated to her, that's not the only reason that she was there. There's a lake right next to it called Avernus. And that stems from the word Aornis, which means no birds. Periodically, that lake belches out toxic fumes that kill absolutely everything in the valley. It's got a terrible history because there are volcanic craters all over the place, and there's a volcano underneath the lake that belches out nasty stuff periodically. It was that experience of realizing the history of that lake and the fact that it was associated as a gateway to the dead. It's actually written up in a lot of the ancient mythology as a place that you could go if you wanted to enter the realm of Hades. And so it makes sense that an oracle of Hera would set up shop in such a terrible place because people who wanted to speak to their dead relatives would think that it would be a good place to go and have a chat with their deceased loved ones.
Amazing stories that you tie together. Matt Kaplan, the author of Science of the Magical, From the Holy Grail to Love Potions to Superpowers. And I was very interested when you talked about lunacy and the effect that the moon might have on us. It is something, you know, yes, I have a scientific bend, but I have noticed a trend of weird things happening when the full moon is around. And you did a little research into the effect that the moon may or may not have on humans, right?
Yeah. So this is the weird thing. I was visiting my family and my sister-in-law in Brussels after a visit to the United States. So I was jet-lagged. I walked into a wall as I was getting up. I kind of literally stumbled down the stairs, and my nieces and nephews wanted to play Legos with me. So you know, of course you do that. But I looked terrible. Which I, you know, it's normal after having an 8-hour time difference. And my sister-in-law walks down and says, "Oh yeah, you know, actually I was reading your star sign. It's going to be a really bad day for you." I'm a scientist, so astrology doesn't hold a lot of weight in my realm. But my day proceeded to get worse and worse. I ended up at a swimming pool with swimming shorts, and they told me that it was a Speedo-only pool. Honestly, a Speedo-only pool.
Really?
And I had to borrow the lifeguard's Speedo to be able to go into the pool with my nieces and nephews. So clearly my sister was onto something, or my sister-in-law was onto something, I mean, if you believe in astrology. But then a couple of months later, this paper rolled across my desk that really, really got me thinking about the effects that at least the moon has on our lives. The researchers published in the journal Current Biology that they noticed that when people... that people slept less overall during periods of the full moon. And you could say, okay, well, maybe it was light of the full moon that was waking them up or causing them to sleep less well. But when you look at the way the study was constructed, the researchers weren't even setting out to do that. They were studying data from people who were put in bunkers at different times of the year to look at sleep problems. The study was not built to study how the moon affected you. The researchers just went back, collected the data, and then correlated that with moon phases and said, oh, wow, this person slept a lot less during the period of the moon. I think it's like 16 minutes less overall of deep sleep at the time of the full moon than not. And that raises all kinds of questions. Why would people sleep less at times of the full moon? Turns out there are other species that have a lunar clock that get them into kind of, you know how you have a circadian rhythm associated with the sun?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are iguanas that on the Galapagos Islands that have a moon clock. They can detect when the tides are going to be really, really low because the moon has a really profound effect on how high or low the tides are. And the iguanas, when they know the tide is going to be really, really low, go out to the ocean and they grab as much algae from the base of the reefs that they go and graze on as they can, because when the tide is really low, they have to swim a lot less. That raises all kinds of questions for humanity. Why would we have any kind of ability to detect the state of the moon? Why would we sleep less at times of the full moon? One of the theories that I get into in the book is we haven't always lived the way we do now for a very, very long time. We were living along the southern coast of Africa and very dependent upon shellfish. And if you want to collect shellfish, it's easy when you first get there because they're all in the shallows. But once you pick that clean, the easiest way to go and get the shellfish is to pay attention to when the tides are really low. So my hypothesis, and it's not been proven, is that we have developed a sensitivity to the state of the moon because once upon a time we were dependent upon knowing when the tides were particularly low. It's kind of like the early bird catches the worm, only the early waker catches the shellfish.
Or early iguana catches the algae.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Matt, I wanted to ask, we just have a couple of minutes left. It's a question that you pose in the beginning of your book, Science of the Magical. Does knowing how something magical works make it into something other than magic?
I think it goes both ways. Personally, I found it also depends upon who you are. For me, I love knowing how things work. I find it endlessly fascinating. I am much more excited knowing how an incredible magic trick on the stage, like watching Penn and Teller, works. I am just as excited in learning how the mythology that our ancestors came to believe in worked. How did they come up with the myth that they did, and was there anything real behind it? I love digging into that stuff. And so for me, dispelling the magic is a great deal of fun. But for a lot of folks, and I get this, it's actually a lot more fun not to know, to just go, oh, my God, that's amazing, and then say, I don't want to know how it worked. It was amazing. Don't ruin it for me. So I think it really varies with the individual.
Well, I love all the stories, and I love learning a lot of the science, too, Matt. Thank you very much for taking time to talk this morning.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Science of the Magical, from the Holy Grail to love potions to superpowers, the latest from author Matt Kaplan. You can learn more about it at our website, wvxu.org. And if you like that one, you might like his previous book, The Science of Monsters, as well. This is The Book Club at 91.7. You've been listening to The Book Club at 91.7. Technical director for the show is Rick Anders. Producer is Kevin Reynolds. Assistant producer is Catherine Cunningham. Web guru is Jim Nolan. And I'm Mark Purcell. Daniel Levitin's best-selling book, The Organized Mind, is now out in paperback. I'll talk with him next time about thinking straight in the age of information overload. And a new thriller from James Rollins explores the origins of human intelligence. He'll be here to tell you about The Bone Labyrinth, his newest Sigma Force novel. Those books and more next Saturday on The Book Club at 91.7. Stay tuned for Weekend Edition next on WVXU. Have a great Saturday.